No, Mickey is on vacation this week. And Sunday afternoon before he left, he told me that he really didn't feel like he had completely wound up the discussion that we had Wednesday night last week on the sixth chapter of Galatians. So he asked me if I would do that. And he smiled when he asked me that. So, anyway, I think he always likes to leave me with a challenge. As we begin this evening, John Grigowski, can I get you to direct our minds in prayer? Okay, so as we're still in our authority class on Lesson 8 on the pattern for benevolence, we have recently studied 2 Corinthians 9:13 and James 1:27, and we've been involved in a study in particular in the sixth chapter of Galatians. So what I would like to do this evening is to see if we can't establish the total context of the book of Galatians, the letter of Galatians, and thereby establish what the context of the sixth chapter is, and in particular, verses 6 and verse 10 of the sixth chapter of Galatians. Now, as we go through the letter of Galatians, I want you to think of the number 3, because we can probably divide the letter to the Galatians into 3 parts. The first part is personal, you might say. Paul's making a defense of his apostleship. He's making a defense of the genuineness and the divine nature of his apostleship. And then based on that genuine apostleship that he has through Jesus Christ, Paul throughout chapters 3 and 4 of Galatians writes to the Galatians about a doctrinal matter. Very doctrinal, so to speak. That we're justified by faith through Christ versus trying to return to the old law, to the law of Moses, to accept circumcision and keeping the old law. And then thirdly, in Galatians, we could say it's instructional. based on being justified by faith through Jesus, he instructs the Galatians on some points on faithful living. And also in terms of the number three, when Paul makes his arguments about justification by faith through Jesus versus living under the old law, Paul makes three convincing arguments about that issue, and then he makes three appeals to the Galatians based on those three arguments. And if you want to turn to one verse that probably encapsulates the theme or the entire idea of what Galatians is about, we could turn to the fifth chapter and verse 1. "Stand fast, therefore, in the liberty by which Christ has made us free, and do not be entangled again with a yoke of bondage." This one verse, again, encapsulates the entire subject matter of the letter to the Galatians. Now, let's turn over to the first chapter of the book of Galatians, and we'll see, starting in verse 1, that right out of the gate, Paul says he's an apostle. Not from men or through man, but through Jesus Christ. Paul's defending his apostleship here. He's stating that my apostleship is absolutely divine, of a divine origin. It's not by or through any man. And after this, Paul rebukes the Galatians for, as we see in the sixth verse, "I marvel that you are turning away so soon from him who called you in the grace of Christ to a different gospel." And this kind of reminds us of that quote that maybe many of us know from Julius Caesar, actually, that the infirmity of the Gauls is that they are fickle in their resolves and fond of change and not to be trusted. So that was their reputation. And as a matter of fact, we see this kind of restated in the third chapter in verse 1, where Paul says, "O foolish Galatians, who has bewitched you that you should not obey the truth?" Now, Paul's apostleship was absolutely of divine origin, and it was independent of the other 12 apostles. Let's notice how this develops in the first and second chapters of Galatians. Let's take a look at verse 11 in chapter 1. "But I make known to you, brethren, that the gospel which was preached by me is not according to man." So it's not from man. "I neither received it from man, nor was I taught it, but it came through the revelation of Jesus Christ." We see that in the 15th verse, Paul says, "But when it pleased God who separated me from my mother's womb and called me through his grace to reveal his son in me." So we see there that God revealed his son to Paul, and in the 17th verse, as Paul is here in these verses recounting somewhat of an autobiography of himself, starting when, "For you have heard of my former conduct in Judaism," back in the 13th verse. Paul's recounting some history here, and he's going to use this history to show that his apostleship, again, is of a divine origin, and it's independent of the other apostles. So in verse 18, in verse 17, notice, "Nor did I go up to Jerusalem to those who were apostles before me, but I went to Arabia and returned again to Damascus. Then after 3 years, I went up to Jerusalem to see Peter and remained with him 15 days. So when he went back to Jerusalem, he saw only who? Peter and James for a period of 15 days. But he didn't immediately go to those who were apostles. Remember, he went to Arabia for 3 years. So he didn't go up to Jerusalem to be taught by the apostles, but he received his apostleship. He received this by revelation. Roy?
Question on verse 11, I'm going to back you up on this, let me be clear on this. Did Jesus verbally teach anything to Paul, or what's that mean by revelation?
That he was taught the gospel by revelation from God. He wasn't taught versus being taught by man.
He was taught by Jesus. But I'm just curious, what do you mean by revelation? Did it come to him like, it came?
Yes.
Okay.
So yes, by revelation. Right, and let's not forget what John 16:13 says. You know that verse, Joey. David?
We know Jesus said some things to Paul, though, because over in 2 Corinthians chapter 12, Paul quotes three times, three times I pleaded with the Lord to take it away from me, but the Lord said, my grace is sufficient. So there's self in Jesus. Yeah, and then you also have the Lord's
right.
Corinthians where Christ talked about the do this and then the blood and the cup. So there was an exchange other than just the Lord.
That's true. But the point is what Paul's writing about here is that apparently we see in the first and second chapters of Galatians, what's going on here in the churches of Galatia is that his apostleship is being attacked, it's being undermined. Okay? He's setting out here right out of the gate defending his apostleship. And he's drawing a contrast saying, I didn't receive this gospel from mankind. I received it by revelation. Now, exactly right. Did you hear that, Roy? You see, if one way to attack the message that Paul had preached to the churches in Galatia was to attack his apostleship, they could say, well, Paul's not really an apostle like the other apostles, so you really don't have to listen to his message. Okay? And in the second chapter, that story that David is bringing up about Peter, when Paul withstood Peter to his face because Peter was playing the role of a hypocrite, this is supporting the genuineness of Paul's apostleship.
It shows his authority.
Okay? So we see in these first two chapters, and we see also, let me add that we see in the second chapter that when Paul had gone up to Jerusalem, we notice in the ninth verse, and when James, Cephas, and John, who seemed to be pillars, perceived the grace that had been given to me, they gave me and Barnabas the right hand of fellowship. So we see here, Roy, for instance, that pillars in the church recognize the apostleship of Paul. Okay? Now, so Paul, writing to the Galatians, had to defend his apostleship. And that's what he's doing in these first two chapters. My apostleship is of divine origin because now, in the third and fourth chapters, what I'm going to do is I'm going to write to you about a doctrinal issue. I'm going to write to you about justification through Jesus Christ versus accepting circumcision and trying to go back and live under the law of Moses. Okay? See, for Paul to write about that doctrinal issue, he is establishing the genuineness and the divine origin of his apostleship. That's what he's doing here. Joey? Right.
He is just as legitimate as the other apostles.
Right. Because, as we'll see later, what was going on was there were some false teachers in these churches in Galatia undermining Paul's apostleship. That's how they were attacking Paul's message. That's what the first two chapters are about. Okay? So, Randy?
I guess I all the particulars about how Revelation happened. We just know that it did. But we have several records of constant communication going on between Jesus and Paul. In Acts chapter 16, verse 6, it says they passed through the Phrygian and Galatian region, having been forbidden by the Holy Spirit to speak the word in Asia. And when they had come to Mysia, they were trying to go to Bithynia, but the Spirit of Jesus did not permit them.
Mm-hmm.
And then over in chapter 18, verse 8, Crispus, the leader of the synagogue, believed in the Lord with all his household. Many of the Corinthians, when they heard, were believing and being baptized. And the Lord said to Paul in the night by a vision, "Do not be afraid any longer, but go on speaking and do not be silent. For I am with you, and no man will attack you in order to harm you, for I have many people in this city." And he settled there for a year and 6 months, teaching the word of God among them. I just mean that the revelation was an ongoing thing. It wasn't that Jesus sat down with Paul and said, "Here's the gospel," and that was the end of it.
Or just on the road to Damascus. Right.
Well, you can find that in Acts 22 and 26 as well. But over in chapter 27, after the shipwreck, or I guess just before the shipwreck, in verse 25, when Paul says, "Therefore keep up your courage, men, for I believe God that will turn out exactly as I've been told." Well, who's telling them?
Okay.
You know, we have a constant source of communication going on between me and the Lord. So
I thought that the original question was, you know, revelation, not so much communication. I mean, certainly the examples that Randy cited are good examples of communication going on. But I don't know if those would qualify as examples of new revelation or new law.
Roy's question had more of a sense to it of a particular point in time. But anyways, we see that Paul goes through and establishes the divine origin of his apostleship. Now he's going to write to them about this doctrinal issue. And as we took a look a moment ago, in the first verse of chapter 3, "O foolish Galatians, who bewitched you that you should not obey the truth? This only I want to learn from you. Did you receive the Spirit by the works of the law or by the hearing of faith?" And now, "O foolish Galatians, who has bewitched you that you should not obey the truth, before whose eyes Jesus Christ was clearly portrayed among you as crucified?"
Okay, the phrase that you did not obey the truth is not in the New American Standard translation. That's not even there. Is that the Old American Standard you got?
No, New King James. Some older texts omit that phrase that you're referring to.
It's just strange because usually the New American Standard shows it as a marginal. It's not found in some manuscripts or something.
Okay. But now, in about verses 1 through 15, 14 or 15, Paul makes the argument that the argument that he makes. The blessings from God come by or through the, as he put it in verse 2, by the hearing of faith. Blessings from God did not come through keeping the old law. Okay? And underpinning that argument, he says, look at Abraham. Abraham was justified by faith prior to the existence of the law. And he says in verse 9, "So then those who are of faith are blessed with believing Abraham." The point is, Abraham was justified by faith prior to the existence of the law. Now, in verses 10 through basically about 12, he argues that the law doesn't bring justification, the law brings condemnation. And in verses 13 and 14, he says, look what Christ has done. Christ has redeemed us from the curse of the law. He refers to the law as a curse. But he goes on. From about verse 15 down through about verse 25, and notice if we back up to verse 23, but before faith came, we were kept under guard by the law, kept for the faith which would afterward be revealed. Okay, for the faith which would what? Afterward be revealed. Therefore, the law was our tutor to bring us to Christ, that we might be justified by faith. But after faith has come, we are no longer under a tutor. So Paul is really saying in this section of text from about, starting with maybe about verse 15 through about verse 25, that the nature of the law of Moses is that it was what? It's temporary. Okay? It's only temporary. So the blessings of God come by the hearing of faith, and the law of Moses is only temporary, and thirdly, starting at verse 26 down through the seventh verse of chapter 4, Paul says that under the law, we were children, and the law was like a guardianship over us while we were children. But then what happens to children? Children grow up, they become of full age, and Paul says they become what? They become heirs, don't they? So he's drawing a contrast and saying that under the old law, he's really saying that there was immaturity under the old law, and there is maturity under the law of Christ, under justification by faith through Christ. Notice in verse 1 of chapter 4. Now I say that the heir, as long as he is a child, does not differ at all from a slave, though he is master of all, but is under guardians and stewards until the time appointed by the father. Even so we, when we were children, were in bondage under the elements of the world. But when the fullness of time had come, God sent forth his Son, born of a woman, under the law, to redeem those who were under the law, that we might receive the adoption as sons. And in verse 7, therefore you are no longer a slave, but a son, and if a son, then an heir of God through Christ. Under the law of Moses, we were children under a guardianship. But when Christ came, we are adopted sons. Who can receive an inheritance?
Terry?
Yes.
I liken it to a father who's raising a child. When you're a parent and you're talking to a child who's 6, 7, 8 years old, you're going to speak to him differently, in a different way than you will when he turns 18. You'll address different subject matter. You'll word things differently. You'll address him in a different way because you know that when he's 18, he's mature enough that he can understand and comprehend things that he couldn't when he was 6 or 7. And that reminds me of Hebrews 1, where it says, in these last days, God has spoken to us through his Son. If you will, mankind has grown up, you know, his relationship with God. He's now an adult, if you will, at the start of this new age, you know, where he now speaks to us through his Son. And God deals with us differently and speaks to us differently now than he did when his followers and believers were
right.
In a childlike state.
Because Paul is saying we're like now sons who are at full age and in a sense possess an inheritance, right? I mean, in a sense we possess an inheritance because if we obey the will of Christ, we have the promise of eternal salvation. So, Paul makes these three arguments that blessings from God come through the hearing of faith, not through the old law. The nature of the old law is temporary. And we were like children under a guardianship versus being sons at full age in possession of an inheritance. And then, in the rest of the fourth chapter, and down to about the 12th verse or so of the fifth chapter, Paul makes three appeals to the Galatians based on these three arguments. And the first appeal that he makes is in about verses 8 through 11 or 12, where he says in verse 9, "But now after you have known God, or rather are known by God, how is it that you turn again to the weak and beggarly elements to which you desire again to be in bondage? You observe days and months and seasons and years. I am afraid for you, lest I have labored for you in vain." Paul's really appealing to their pride here. He's saying, why do you want to turn to a weakened condition? Why do you want to return to this ceremonialism and ritualism and observe days and weeks and seasons and months? And then he appeals to them based on his affection for the Galatians. We see in about the 19th verse, he refers to them as my little children. And he says in the 16th verse, have I become your enemy because I tell you the truth? And in the balance of the text that I pointed out, he makes a longer appeal to them really based on their intelligence. Now, and you've studied this before, but you know, he makes this appeal to them about the two covenants. How that you don't want to be the son of a bondwoman, you want to be the son of the free woman. I think many of us remember studying that from in years past. We've studied this before. And he goes and he appeals to them and tells them that if you become circumcised, Christ will profit you nothing because you become a debtor to keep the whole law. And circumcision and uncircumcision avails nothing. And he also kind of winds it up by saying, if I still preach circumcision, why do I still suffer persecution? Then the offense of the cross has ceased. And that's in verse 11 of chapter 5. So he makes these appeals to the Galatians based on their pride, based on his affection for them, based on their intelligence, if you will. And now that he's instructed them in this doctrinal matter, now that he's argued that justification is through faith in Jesus Christ, and it is not through keeping the old law, he's going to instruct them about faithful living, starting in about verses 12 or 13 of chapter 5 through the 10th verse of the 6th chapter of Galatians. Now, one thing that I forgot to point out was back up in verses 7, 8, and 9 of the 5th chapter, Paul writes, you ran well, who hindered you from obeying the truth? Remember, I'm a genuine apostle. I'm writing to you the truth. Who hindered you from obeying the truth? This persuasion does not come from him who calls you. This persuasion does not come from God. A little leaven leavens a whole lump. In other words, this persuasion comes from this evil influence known as the false teachers who are teaching you, who are trying to undermine me and trying to teach you to return to the old law, to accept circumcision and live and keep the old law. But in instructing them in faithful living, Paul writes to them If you bite and devour one another, beware lest you be consumed by one another. I mean, can you imagine the factions that this would set up by, so to speak, by a faction within a congregation or congregations of false teachers trying to undermine a teacher who is teaching the truth? So Paul writes, walk in the Spirit, and you shall not fulfill the lust of the flesh. And what does Paul do? He enumerates what? The works of the flesh. And he enumerates the fruit of the Spirit, or living by the Spirit. And he says, if we live in the Spirit, let us also walk in the Spirit. Let us not become conceited, provoking one another, envying one another. So, brethren, if a man is overtaken in any trespass, you who are spiritual, restore such a one in the spirit of gentleness, considering yourself, lest you also be tempted. Now, we discussed this verse in verses 1 through 5 last Wednesday night. And what we're talking about here in verses 1 through 5 is we're talking about spiritual matters. We're not talking about temporal matters here. This is the context. Now, in verse 6, let him who is taught the word share in all good things with him who teaches. Now, it was pointed out last week, and I think some versions use, instead of share, use the word communicate. And Richard, I think that was pointed out last week that that word was what? Koinonia? Yeah. Which means joint participation. Now, okay, I didn't quite get to it. Okay, why would this verse, why would verse 6 all of a sudden appear talking about a relationship between a teacher and the one who is taught? I mean, is this verse to be lifted out in isolation and given an interpretation that's completely foreign to the context here about temporal matters, in other words, about supporting a preacher? Or could it be that we're talking about the relationship here between the teacher and the one who is taught, sharing joint participation in all things that are of good or of spiritual benefit, because this is what's going on in the churches in Galatia, is that Paul is having his credibility as a teacher undermined by these false teachers. Now, Paul writes, do not be deceived, God is not mocked, for whatever a man sows, that he will also reap. For he who sows to his flesh will of the flesh reap corruption, but he who sows to the Spirit will of the Spirit reap everlasting life. Again, these are spiritual matters we're talking about here. We're talking about eternal salvation. And let us not grow weary while doing good, for in due season we shall reap if we do not lose heart. Therefore, as we have opportunity, Let us do good to all, especially to those who are of the household of faith. So, in this context, what is the good talked about in verse 10? Sharing the gospel. Remember, Paul has defended his apostleship. He's instructed them on a doctrinal matter. He's giving them instruction on faithful living. He's giving them instructions about how to walk by the Spirit. Oh, Joey, what would you say is the good here in verse 10?
Well, what I say is the good?
Yeah.
By its very wording, it's a very generic statement, so I don't know that I can be more specific than what's written there.
Okay.
I don't know how else I can.
Okay.
I don't know that you can elaborate on that anymore.
Carolyn?
You talked about kind of ignoring the chapter breakdown and going back up
right.
to verses 22 and 23, fruits of the Spirit, those being the good things that we're sharing with those in the household of faith.
Okay.
Verse 10.
Well, what would it be in this context, Richard?
Well, the fact of the matter is this, as you, I think, have been trying to point out, context here is one big, long context. And so if we go back, as Carolyn mentioned, to verse 22 and talk about the fruit of the Spirit, and then we go to 6:1, it says, you are spiritual, restore such a one. And then when you go down in verse 2, it says, fulfill the law of Christ. And then... it talks about in verse 8, it makes a comparison of the flesh and the Spirit. And so when we get down here, we can't all of a sudden say that this is something different than what we've always been talking about.
You can't all of a sudden say that switch subjects to something totally foreign to the context.
That'd be it.
Okay. Okay, thank you very much.